Episode 19 of our 16th season, it's time for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio is Miles Elam. He's a software engineer and political junkie, as you probably know. Hey, Miles.
How's it going?
And Brian Young, an iOS developer, designer, and software conference producer.
I do. I produce them big.
So we can keep reading the intros, even though it's a podcast. We don't have to like do that thing that we do for radio. We're going to keep doing the intros because it's fun to like formally introduce you guys.
Yeah, but so much for that not editing.
No one knows that I'm not going to edit this or I'm going to edit this. From here on out, no editing. So don't swear.
We have to have the intros as our like roles change in life.
That's the thing is you've got to change them over time a little bit.
Yeah, well, we always have.
And you're, yeah, good. I'm glad.
I'll be a sheep herder in another month.
You're getting sheep?
I'm getting sheep.
Are you actually going to be herding them? Do you actually have a field?
Yes, we have grass that needs to be shorn.
And so I thought you had goats.
Yeah, well,
we have goats, but goats don't eat grass. Goats are browsers, not foragers. Or, sorry, browsers, not grazers.
I thought goats eat everything.
Sorry, foragers, not grazers.
Okay, wait a second.
They all browse.
Okay, they all browse. All right. They're foragers, not grazers. So sheep are grazers.
Mm-hmm.
All of them to some degree are grazers, right? Like if a sheep's going along and there's something really tasty like a rosebud, it's going to eat it, right?
Yeah, they're pretty much limited to ground level.
Really?
Yeah.
What, so does that mean that goats do not eat grass? Is grass too hard for them to digest?
They'll get some grass, but it's not their preference. They'd like to go up.
Does height matter? Like if I put a potted plant of grass at like 4 feet, would they eat that? No, I mean, it's the food itself. It's not the location.
Well,
right?
Yes, but I mean, the natural state of where the food comes from. That's just how they came to be, is that they...
That's why they climb.
Yeah, they get up and around and they grab branches. They grab the leaves off the branches.
So a goat that is eating grass, does he get RSI in his neck?
No, they can eat grass. It's just they...
Are you saying that your goats do not eat grass, basically? You need some kind of grazer so
yes.
They can get rid of your grass?
Yes, absolutely.
Wow, I didn't know that. I started cutting grass with a scythe about a week ago.
I saw that. And did you see my message to you?
What?
I wanted to rent it.
Yeah. It is really cool to use. Like, I really enjoyed using it. Did you see that video I made?
I did. I had my son in it. How long does it take to sharpen that blade?
You know, once it's sharp, it's pretty easy to keep it going. You have to do it every 10 minutes or so.
I love this. How this is geek speak.
So a scythe, of course, is like the Grim Reaper, a large metal blade. And it's designed such that you kind of swing it in front of you as you're walking. And the things that are really cool about it is that when the grass is really tall, you can use it. You can't use a lawnmower when the grass is really tall because it's really hard to use, right? You can use a weed whacker. And the other thing that's cool about it is, unlike a lawnmower, when you cut it, the grass just kind of falls. It doesn't get all chewed up. And so we're trying to get rid of foxtails on our property so the dogs don't get messed up with the foxtails. And so we're just cutting the grass, and then we pile it up, and it's pretty easy to sweep. Your kids were helping sweep last week.
Yeah, they were.
Or rake, I should say.
Child labor.
The other thing that's cool is you can totally use it when the grass is wet. So when it's dewy in the morning, a lawnmower can get clogged up. No problem with the scythe.
You're saying it actually worked better, actually.
It works a lot better because there's more mass of the grass, and so it doesn't get knocked over, gets cut. And you got to keep that blade really sharp. But it's kind of fun to have a giant, long, sharp blade. I'm so scared of that thing. I'm going to cut my fingers off. Lyle loses his job. No more programming for him.
So this is like the old tech podcast.
It is. And talk about cool tech. I have to say, I had a weed whacker and lawnmowers. And I have to maintain them and keep them. And, you know, they're great. But it's a pain. And it's smelly. And you get oil. And you're using fossil fuels. And this thing, you like pick it up. And you swing your body back and forth, walk through a field. By the time you're done, you're sweating. But it's not like really hard. It's not like digging ditches hard.
Yeah, but it's not like the old days. You're using like an aluminum shaft scythe,
it
right?
It is really light. Yeah, it's really light. I got to get you guys both trying it. Miles, you're welcome to borrow it and use it. It is.
Thanks.
But then again, you're getting sheep. So
wait,
you don't need it.
I'm going to take them home tonight, so I can get it.
The grass has gone out of control, and actually there are foxtails, so I need to take it down.
Oh, because they don't eat foxtails? Sheep?
We don't have the sheep yet, so.
But you're getting sheep.
Yes.
All right.
Like I said, in a month I'll be a goat herd or a sheep herder.
So this is what happens when we leave radio.
We go down a rabbit hole.
So speaking of rabbit holes, so this is now technically only a podcast, or awesomely a podcast is a better way to say it than only a podcast. And Marco Arment had a great article about podcasts that you kind of wanted to sum up a bit. And this was inspired by
a New York Times investigative article, maybe a rumor article. or maybe a leaked article. It's always hard to tell. Mm-hmm. But it was an article about how Apple recently hosted a gathering of the top podcast groups or podcast networks to talk about what they're looking for, what they need to help podcasting in general. But let me back up a little bit. Mm. So do you remember when GeekSpeak first became a podcast? What year was that?
It was 2005, December of 2005, I think.
We were talking about this recently. And it became a podcast then because Apple had recently created a podcast directory, right? Mm-hmm. You did it within a few months when they started that.
RSS had always been a very common format for GeekSpeak. In fact, we had an RSS feed of our show really early on because Miles and I actually built out an XML system to run the site. So it was really easy to translate a version for RSS. And RSS is blogs, like a blog is an RSS feed, or traditionally was. And at one point, the support of adding an enclosure into it, meaning an audio file reference inside a blog entry, allowed potentially to download that audio file. And of course, there were no clients out there. And at one point, Apple released a version of iTunes that had that in there, which means that if you subscribed, it would automatically check and download audio files for you. And hence, podcasting was really became popular. Well, became possible, feasible.
Well, it exploded in popularity too. Yeah. And within a year, NPR was releasing several shows on.
In fact, within a year, NPR came to KOSP at the time and said, "Hey, what shows could we move into our network so we can actually have a whole bunch of your stuff in our network?" And that's when we moved our GeekSpeak episode to NPR, is because NPR wanted to do it. And I said, "Well, we already have the file. It's pretty easy. Here you go."
So some people look at Apple as creating podcasts, but they didn't.
No.
It was around for at least a couple of years. In fact, I don't remember his name, but there was somebody that was really petitioning Apple to do this because they wanted podcasting to become a thing, because people were already trying to do it, but they didn't have a big player to support them.
Sure.
So Apple took on podcasting and they made a directory, and this directory just hosted the RSS feeds, right?
And
kind of gives descriptions on what the show is and allows you to give ratings. And
it used to be that if you were using iTunes and you wanted to subscribe to a podcast that wasn't in the directory, you could just paste in the URL for the RSS file or the Atom file. And once you did that, iTunes saw that and then listed and then accessed and scanned that podcast and added it to the system.
That actually added it to the iTunes directory?
Wasn't anything special you have to do to add a file other than somebody has to use it and has to be a public URL. So it became a very large network really quickly. No individual had to go up and do anything. In fact, for a long time, Apple didn't know that me as a user was the person that owned the GeekSpeak RSS feed, right? You finally were able to do that at one point by some stuff they added in. But early on, all of them just showed up kind of like a Google search.
Yeah. So Apple's role in podcasting was creating this directory, and then they pretty much did nothing with it.
They've done nothing.
It stayed in iTunes. They did relatively recently, I think it's been 3, maybe 4 years, that they made an iOS podcasting app.
Yeah. They did a few things that were pretty interesting. They added a whole bunch of namespace stuff that's about iTunes directly. For example, there's no spec out there that talks about what kind of content you're talking about, right? So meta tags and stuff, specifically explicit or not, language in the podcast.
Based on their music system.
Yeah. So Apple has produced a doc and actually talks about this. You give it a namespace of iTunes and you can give other tags. And one of the things they like is large art, an iTunes description, which shouldn't have an HTML because the description tag normally has a whole bunch of HTML in it. So they kind of cleaned up and allowed for other kind of categories. And that's why you kind of and a lot of people actually use that. And now podcast feeds just have those iTunes tags in them as well. And other directories use the same tag. So they kind of like enhance the spec.
Is that what they call the extensions to the RSS?
That's the extensions.
That regular RSS readers get a little confused about or
potentially
ignore.
If you're a good XML parser, though, you'll just ignore a namespace you're not aware of. So they did it completely valid. I mean, it was a completely valid way of doing it. If you go to the W3C, which is like the World Wide Web Consortium's XML parser, they actually have a podcasting parser service, and they actually recognize and give you feedback on your iTunes tags. So it's become kind of a de facto standard.
Right.
Much like OpenGraph has been for web pages and articles.
And OpenGraph, of course, is Facebook's format of extended metadata on web pages.
Yeah. So they made a podcasting app 3 or 4 years ago for iOS, but there's been many other podcasting apps that have been around for a while, including Marco Arment's relatively recent addition. I think he's had Overcast out for, 2 years now?
Yeah, it's something like that.
Maybe a little less.
We've actually spoke about Overcast on the show like six times now. It feels like it's – anyway, go on.
Well, so we both like it.
He's an independent software developer, and this podcast is really quite good. One of the things that I use it all the time for is you can speed up the audio playback, and it's really clean. And he has some automatic compression built into it. So it's a great app. Absolutely.
Yeah, and he's got his own take on the directory and stuff like that. But the thing about Marco is he made that app specifically because he recognized as a podcaster himself that there are a lot of interests out there in the world that want to capitalize on podcasts and make money on them. And he has his own way of making money on his podcast and stuff like that. But he was concerned that if any one player were able to get control over podcasts in a large way, they might be able to change it from the open standard it is now into something that would be, the days of IE where Microsoft started making their own standards that were locking other people out.
Another example of this, of like a walled garden, that podcasting is not that, right?
Right.
Facebook right now has the ability for you to upload images and videos and share them with your friends. And if you do that, that seems great and it seems to be all open and everybody can connect to you. Except the truth is those files that you upload, you can't actually see them unless you're part of Facebook. So there is some public facing of this, but really what their goal of it is to suck you into this Facebook ecosystem.
Exactly.
So if podcasting were like that, the content would kind of be owned by those big players. YouTube is a perfect example. This YouTube basically owns video on the internet, video that is like podcasting in the sense that individuals produce it and then they share it, and they share it by putting it on YouTube, and then YouTube actually gets to monetize part of it. Podcasting is not like that. It hasn't been. And so this concern would be that if Apple – potentially. I mean, what's Marco concerned about?
Well, okay, so now enter this New York Times article. When you read the article, it's this positive take about how these large podcasters are looking for a way to expand podcasting, make it bigger, make it more of a way to make money. And when you read the article, the one thing that the podcasters seem to be asking for, and these are unstated podcasters, we don't know who they are, which large networks they are. They seem to be asking for data about the listeners.
You mean the people that had this private meeting with them?
The people who had the private meeting with Apple. They seem to be asking for, according to this article, data about the listeners. And, of course, we know all about this kind of technique from the open web with web advertising. Web advertisers love to know how many clicks there are, who the person is, and try to, put the data together to figure out who you are as you wander from each site. So if this were to happen, if for some reason Apple chose to listen to this criticism and try to in some way make a system that would allow podcasters to get this data to monetize this information, they would have to make a more closed system. It wouldn't be the open system. It would be only certain podcast players would be able to provide this information, and those large podcasters may only allow their podcast available through these kind of clients.
On the flip side, podcasts right now have a really hard time figuring out how to make money from what they're doing. So you have people making deals with Audible or just trying to find some other way to get advertisements in there. So it's that back and forth of when you don't have the big player in there, you have to do so much of that legwork yourself.
Yeah, so we have the equivalent of like 50s television right now. It's commercials that are in the podcast, but nobody knows who's actually listening to the commercials because most podcast players allow a convenient way to skip over them. Mm-hmm. But they're
or
in
even
there.
Or even who's playing them. I mean, like the data that we get on the GeekSpeak podcast, for example, I know how many people have actually downloaded audio files from our server because I host the audio files, and I know how many unique IPs grab the RSS file. So I kind of have an idea of how many are kind of subscribed.
But you don't know.
But I don't know how many people are playing.
Right.
Right.
Right. And somebody also could have left it in their client to download it and not listen to it for years.
And it is true that if we came up with a really great system that benefited everybody, wouldn't that be wonderful? But the truth is that any decision that's made is going to shape the entire experience for everybody. And right now, with Apple being really hands-off, it's grown and been popular, and who knows if they were more on hands-on, if it would be different.
Right.
I mean, so they're making a lot of money on their App Store, and their App Store model is very clearly anybody that wants to put any content on there has to be a member, has to spend $100 a year, has to then get reviewed on anything that's put up, and after their review process gets put up, it goes up, and then if any money is made there, Apple gets a cut of it. If that happened to podcasting, it would be horrible.
Yeah. It would take an open system like the web and turn it into the walled garden.
So a big thing, a big shift happened in podcasts in this last year as Serial became extremely popular. And the New York Times article references that as well. Hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions of people, actually listened to the Serial podcast. And because of that, people started listening to podcasts. And my hope is – I mean honestly, I kind of hope that Apple does nothing and just keeps exactly the same because I'm so concerned, scared I guess, about what they could do that could be bad. What's your take on it?
I love podcasting the way it is. I love the weird, wonderful world that you can find anything you want to – any topic you want to find out about. Somebody's talking about it. And I love the unproduced shows. I love the ones that you just hear the raw take of what somebody thinks about. And there's plenty of shows I listen to that are monetized, that have ads in them. And I hear the same ads in all the shows.
Yeah.
But
I find the ads kind of frustrating. But then again, I'm from a public radio person. So
yeah, I understand their need to make some money. It's hard to do it for free.
Speaking of ads, if you live if you live near Santa Cruz, come on down to our live event on May 21st. You can learn more about the event. But basically what we're doing is we're – Dr. Don, which is a show that used to be before us on KOSP, and it's just wonderful woman who's extremely smart and very knowledgeable about medicine. Don will do a live show about her show, which is great, and it's fun to see. The geeks will all be there, or hopefully at least some of you guys will be there. I'll be there. And after that show's over, we'll do a little talk about how podcasting actually works, the technical aspect of it, and then how to actually podcast. Of course, the podcast listeners of this show don't need to do that because you're already listening. But if you want to come down and meet us.
If you're in Santa Cruz and you have somebody who's always wanted to get into podcasting, maybe this is a good chance for them to visit.
We'll definitely speak on the sidelines. I'll show the gear. I mean, we're going to be doing the show from there so you can see all the gear that we use and what happens and get a chance to meet us and stuff. So if you're in the area, please do come down. Find out more. Get free tickets at live.geekspeak.org. Excuse me, live.geekspeak.org. So Miles, cancer?
Yeah, just to before we go into that, I thought it was kind of funny that you were saying that Dr. Don, she's a really smart person because there are a lot of really dumb doctors. I don't know. Anyway, so yes, cancer, cell phones. We've been talking about this since the show began, or at least since we started doing the show 16
Absolutely.
Years ago.
Were there cell phones when we started?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Cell phone was my primary form of communication. I didn't have a landline.
I wore a cell phone on my hip, on Motorola.
Yeah, back when people did that. anyway, so there is a study. There have been several studies that have gone, but many of them have been biased, or they've been a small sample size, or the like. There was one Scandinavian one that did show no real link between them,
between cell phone use and cancer.
Right, and it was showing a huge population there, but. Well, a lot of people still have this worry that, well, I don't know, does it actually cause a problem?
Well, from a geek perspective, the thing that always frustrated me is that the studies always talked about there doesn't seem to be a link, but there's this small chance of inconclusive information that maybe we need to study it more.
Right.
Which is called science.
Yeah, exactly.
And like at the same time, they were saying, well, the worst case scenario is it's less than a banana.
Right. Bananas have potassium in them, and therefore they're
– radioactive more, potassium.
Yeah. Right. Well, all potassium has some radioactive qualities in it. Banana has high potassium, so therefore it has like – it potentially is more dangerous to you to eat a banana a day than to have a cell phone because of cancer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Speaking of bananas, I got a great statistic for you. I'll tell you in a minute.
Okay. Go ahead. So what we need is more data. What we need is longer data. We need more people and get larger sampling size. So Australia –
they've got people.
They've got people, a fair number of them. And they also have universal health care. So they have stats on everyone.
On all the peoples.
Yes. And they have the study going on for 29 years. It was gathering data about cell phone data from 1982 to 2013, I think is when they stopped.
1982?
I believe 1982.
I might be in the data set. I was there for 1 year.
Oh, really? Did you have a mobile phone?
I did not.
Yeah. See, no one effectively had a mobile phone. Statistically speaking, no one had a cell phone.
I think they were called mobile phones at that point.
Yes. And I think they were called suitcases at that point.
Car phones. Car phones.
In 1982. And so that becomes a very good baseline to find out, like, well, does the trend in cancer, for example, brain cancer, which is the big bugaboo that everyone's worried about, does that trend with the number of cell phones and the increasing use of it? And which populations have a higher rate of cell phone use versus others? Do they have a split?
Okay. And you can read the article to find out more. No, I'm just kidding.
And the TLDR version.
Wait, how many people are in this study, do they say?
Australia. That's a value. No, seriously, it's a universal healthcare. So it's everybody that participates in universal healthcare in Australia. How many people?
It was 16 million when I was there. Oh.
That was 82, though.
Yeah, I'm not – I don't see – the population isn't listed in this article. That I'm saying.
It changed too much over the course of the study.
Yeah. One thing that was curious, even though that TLDR, cell phones do not cause brain cancer.
In Australia.
In Australia.
But water goes down the opposite direction there, so you can't trust it.
There are no absolutes in science.
Yes.
However, they did look at – no correlation though.
They did find a slight increase in brain cancer rates among males, not among females, but among males. But – this increase began at the beginning of the study before people started really using cell phones.
Oh, so they saw the trend occurring already prior to cell phones coming into
place. Right. So the question is, was it because of cell phones? Almost certainly not. Like the cause correlation is not causation.
Did they correlate it to the ozone hole?
Actually, it probably correlates with diagnosis. We become so much better at diagnosing disease, whether it be cancers or autism or ADD or ADHD. And so the numbers seem like they're spiking hugely, even though it's about the same amount they've always been. Just we see it more clearly now.
Wow.
19,858 males, 14,222 females diagnosed with brain cancer. That's what, inclusive of the study. That's a lot of people.
Yes.
Yeah.
People get cancer.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. So it's
well, that's good. I'm going to start carrying two cell phones on my head then.
Yeah. So if anything, the study shows that men can get cancer from cell phones, but women don't.
Wait, just say that?
That doesn't make any sense.
They were saying the slight increase in
brain
cancer.
We now have the show title for this episode.
Women can use cell phones, but men, watch out.
Okay, banana update now. Are you done with the story? We're good?
Unless you want to carry an extra cell phone to cause cancer, I think you have to strap like 20 of them to your head now because of the change in radiation from them.
That's true. And I need to become more masculine because if I'm more masculine, it's more likely that I can... So we had a take your kids to work day last week at Netflix, and my daughters came with me and we walked around and got tours and things of that nature, which was cool because when you come to Netflix, you don't have a tour. There's a day where you learn like acronyms and stuff, but basically you're on your own. So anyway, we got a tour of the building, which I've been in for like 6 months because it's a brand new building. And the person that was walking us around is the facilities manager. So she handles if people have desk needs, like just the entire building. It's a giant job, and she's the executive director or whatever of that. But one of the things she was telling me some stats, and one of the stats she told me is that we have fresh fruit and all these different every floor has its own like little sub kitchen, and then at the bottom of all the buildings there's a big kitchen. And all those places we stock fruit, including bananas. And so she asked all the kids, how many bananas do we go through at Netflix a month? And we're talking about the offices up here. It's about 1,000 people, I think, because we have maybe 2,000 people staff, and maybe it's more than that. Maybe it's 1,500 people, somewhere in there. How many bananas do you guys think we go through a month at Netflix?
How many employees are at Netflix?
About 1,500, 1,000 to 1,500 up here. And we're just talking about Northern California in Los Gatos.
A month.
Let's see. Maximum rate, 1,500 times 31.
They all eat one a day.
I guess that wouldn't be maximum. We could go two a day.
Yeah.
I'll venture out 125,000.
What? Wait, no. You went high on purpose.
1,500.
10,000 bananas a month.
That's 10, it?
10,000.
That's a lot of bananas.
That's not a lot of bananas. My daughter goes through that many bananas.
A lot of mushing, man.
Anyway. So what's the cancer rate at Netflix?
I don't know. It's probably really high. 10,000 bananas.
Well, not very high. They're only eating 10,000 bananas.
That's a lot of bananas. You don't think that's a lot of bananas?
No.
How many bananas do you eat a day?
Three.
What?
You eat three bananas a day?
You don't understand. There's only so many foods that my daughter will eat, so I end up eating many of the same things that she does.
Wait.
God, we went to a rabbit hole of bananas. I didn't need to know you eat three bananas a day. I just
Well, you shouldn't have asked. Can't handle the truth.
I haven't had a banana in like 3 years. So together we have a pretty average banana usage. I read this great
and together we eat 1.5 bananas a piece.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, kind of.
The math doesn't work.
No, but I haven't done it for 3 years, so no, we eat 1 banana a piece.
The average human being on the planet has only one testicle.
Is this what happens when we get off radio? This is exactly what happens. That you wouldn't have done on KUSP.
I actually would have, I think. No, I would have done that on KUSP.
It's not –
Why would that have not been allowed?
It's juvenile.
Why would that have not
been allowed? No, let's get
back to bananas. That was educational. That was totally appropriate.
It's not educational. That's
the fallacy of statistics.
Yes, that is exactly the fallacy of statistics.
Can you go on?
I'll be editing this podcast. I can feel it.
Bill Gates walks into a bar. How everyone's average wage just went up.
What?
Yes.
Describe this one.
A bunch of people are sitting in a bar. Bill Gates walks in.
Okay.
And a statistician says, good news. Everyone's average wage went up. The average wage in this
Because
bar
he's
went up.
Not working anymore.
No, because he makes so much.
Oh, the average in the room.
Yes. I got it.
All right.
You're trying to move on. We're not letting
I'm trying to move on. It's great. So the YouTube content ID system.
Yeah.
I read this article. I thought it was fascinating. Please do tell us about it, Brian.
Okay. So first of all, article's a little bit harsh on language, but that's okay. So this was a really fascinating subject because what was it? It's been like 5, 6, 7 years. Ever since YouTube became part of Google, the major content players in video have been complaining about pirating and copyrighted work on YouTube. So Google YouTube made the content ID system, allowing automatic flagging of copyrighted content.
That included air quotes. So go on.
Yes, quote unquote copyrighted content. So this initiative, this pressure came from the large copyright holders, large publishers of video.
So Comedy Central has The Daily Show. And The Daily Show, somebody grabs a clip of The Daily Show off their TV. They put it on YouTube. They upload it. They then put an ad in front of it. And you searching YouTube for funny content and you see – what's his name? The new host?
I can't remember the new host.
Trevor Noah.
Yeah. You see Trevor Noah's show and you go, oh, watch this. And there's a little ad in the beginning. And that person that uploaded it gets the money even though Comedy Central owned the content.
Well,
and that's what it's trying to stop.
There's multiple ways.
That's the general reason they have the system in place.
They don't want other people profiting off of content. And the copyright holders have a choice of whether they try to monetize a video that gets put up that
they can theoretically own with their content ID,
or whether they can have it taken down. And the problem with this system is it's very hard for computers to be absolutely sure, number one, whether it's a match, but number two, who the original copyright holder is.
Yes.
So the way the system works is the first one who puts up a claim is the de facto copyright holder, and then somebody else would have to challenge that claim.
Mm-hmm.
And
of course, the large studios and large media conglomerates have better relationships with YouTube, so they can argue stronger in general because they're going
to
have
– trying to remember what I heard there was some sort of automated system that the big content providers just automatically flag, yes, that's ours. Yes,
right.
That's ours. They
right.
don't even have a chance to look at it because there's too much content there coming in. Anyways, so a lot of people get really frustrated with this system. So one video game reviewer decided to take this system on and try to find a way to game it.
Well, now, so wait a second. That's an interesting thing. This person's a reviewer of video games.
Right.
So one of the things they want to do when you're doing a review, especially a video review, is you show a bit of the content.
Right.
And there's a large doctrine of fair use at play with copyright, where if you're talking about factual information, you can use the material. If you're satiring, you can use the material. And in general, if you're reviewing it, if you're talking about it, you should be able to pull quotes from it in the traditional form. And in video, that means showing a bit of it and saying, this is what you think. So there's some gray area about whether it's okay to use other content in your own content based off of the fair use clauses in copyright.
Right. So Content ID is supposed to work where you can use this. You'll get flagged as using copyrighted material, but then you can challenge it and keep your material up there. But in reality, what happens is things get blocked, taken down, or monetized by the copyright holder without you having a chance to do anything.
By the way, if you're watching a YouTube video and you see that the video has been cropped oddly, or it's you notice all of a sudden that an actor's mole is on the wrong side of their face, this is a methodology for trying to fool the Content ID system. If you modify the content well enough, the Content ID system will not detect it because it's an automated process. And Google, of course, you're trying to fight Google on this, so good luck, because over time they'll actually get better at detecting it. But, you know, people will crop it differently. They'll put a border around it. It's very common to actually, like, put content inside a TV so that it looks like it's subcontent. Or it's like it's an image of a TV, and then the content's inside the TV. Anyway, go on.
So this reviewer decided to review a particular game. It doesn't really matter what it was, but he threw in all these clips of irrelevant games. And he goes through it, his entire review, with just random, seemingly random clips from multiple different games, even though he's just talking about one game. And at the end, he finally wants
to... This is Jim Sterling, by the way.
Jim Sterling is the reviewer. He wants to explain why he has all these irrelevant clips in there. And he basically says Content ID is going to flag this as multiple copyright holders. And they're going to fight it out. They're going to go ahead and one large corporation is going to fight with another large corporation on who owns this video and who has the right to monetize it.
It's who has the right to monetize the video, because he's actually being subsidized by his listenership. His listenership likes him so much that they're actually paying him directly through like an Indiegogo fund. So he doesn't have to put an ad in his content at all on YouTube. So he doesn't have an ad. But if he puts a review up there and the review is – the content is from some carrier, some other group, they can put an ad on it and monetize it. So all of a sudden his content gets ads in it even though he can't control it.
But the de facto – of what happens in this situation, and he says he's proved this multiple times, is everyone gives up and then nobody monetizes it.
Which is what he wants. He doesn't want to see ads, which is awesome. Very smart. Very smart way of dealing with this. I'm assuming, though, if this happened enough, the big players would start making relationships where they split monetization or something.
They're going to have to do that, I suppose. But as long as this works, somebody's found a way to game the system.
Now, of course, at the same time, Jim Sterling's not actually making money directly from this YouTube video.
No, he's making money off of his opinion through Indiegogo, you said. Right?
Something like that. I'm not sure if it's Indiegogo, but some other form. He got funding
Patreon. He's using Patreon.
Yeah, he got funded from somebody else, which is cool because what this actually means is that YouTube's not making any money from this at all, right? Because there's no ads being played on it. His audience gets to see it. They see that he's making Patreon requests, and they go and give him money through a different external source. So.
Which really, I think everyone would agree, this is the way the system should work in this case.
Well, I got to say that I don't think YouTube's going to like this over time because this loses revenue for them. And they are making money on the hosting service by putting ads in it. So interesting. I'd love to watch this space. I think it's very smart of them to do this, and I like the idea of getting rid of ads by using the system against itself. It's pretty awesome. Okay. Well, let's – what do you think? I want to hear about the story. You were put this low on your list, but can you tell me about user ratings?
Yeah, sure. This is a story from Ars Technica. It talks about user ratings, for example, the ones you find on Amazon – which I use, and a lot of people reference to say, like, oh, should I buy this product? How many people reviewed it? What's the star rating?
Yeah, but you have your own heuristics on how you read those, don't you?
Sure. But in general, the user ratings are unreliable, and many of us don't account for it adequately.
Can we talk about like something factual, like Amazon? Amazon's reviews I use all the time. Mm-hmm. I buy products based off of what people are saying about it.
Mm-hmm. Do you buy a product that has 1-star reviews in it?
No. Well, no. If it has a few 1-star reviews, I read those to get a feeling if it was like seemed like a one time event. Normally, someone's pissed off about something specific. So yeah, I normally read the ones and I read a few of the fives and I look at the averages. So mm-hmm. Are you saying that those are no good?
Well. It has a sampling bias in and of itself that the people who are more likely to review are a certain personality type. The people who are more likely to review had either a very negative or very positive experience, so they get heavily weighted one way or another. Mm-hmm. And people have a hard time actually even correctly saying that this is a 3-star versus what is a 5-star versus a 1-star experience, because for them, you know, the example that's given in the Ars article is 5 stars. My girl students love the color of this tablet that they've
right.
You know, as opposed to, oh, it's choppy, or some other person saying, yes, I love the new operating system. Like, what does that have to do with the hardware when you're just talking about the operating system? And so what they were what some people were trying to do, and this is in a recent paper in the Journal of Consumer Research, is that when they looked at something like Consumer Reports, something that is user-driven, you know, subscriber-driven, to buy products and then test them all out and see, you know, which washing machine works the best and which one has good reliability and customer
research
support.
This is research-based reviewing.
And they don't really correlate.
You mean the Amazon-like reviews don't correlate with what the expert reviewer system
– Right. In fact, some of the correlations were actually negative. In other words, the higher the Consumer Reports score, the lower the Amazon rating became.
Wow. That's really fascinating, because I've always assumed that if you get a lot of people's experiences with something that you can trust – like let's say 500 people experience, you know, some product, some tennis shoes, and they're all going, these are great in general – I would assume that those are pretty good pair of tennis shoes.
But you're relying on a large group to review it, right? You wouldn't get the same sense from a 13-person review.
A 13-person review I pretty much ignore, right? Like I'm normally looking at larger values at that. But even at like 300 people, that's enough people where generally I'll agree with them. If the idea is that if they're all happy, I'll probably be happy too because I'm like them. Like what's wrong with that?
At 6 reviewers, you know, we probably all recognize that's probably not a good sample size.
Right.
And at 300, it gets better. And when we see the ones that are like 2,000, we go, hey, that's pretty good. Except that human beings are drawn to brand name, for example. Yeah. They're drawn to, I paid this amount of money for it, therefore it is worth this versus not that.
My $20 bottle of wine is much better than your $5 bottle of wine.
And many people buy a single washing machine or maybe two if the first one
they don't
one
know anything about them really, right.
And you don't have that comparison to say which one is better than another one. They're pleased with the one they got.
So for example, you have like 5 washing machines available on Amazon. Mm-hmm. And one of them is a big brand name, Superpants washing machines. And so like 4 people happen to buy that one and give it great reviews. From there on out, you're going to get the masses just kind of buying the one that looked good. And when they get it, they're happy with it. But if you actually looked at them and compared the two of them, everyone would be happier with a different one. It's just that they're only getting one of them. Is that kind of the idea of it?
Kind of like that, yeah.
Yeah, that this makes sense.
So, I mean, there is a safety in brand recognition to say like, well, I had this in the past. I mean, people do it with cars all the time. Like, I had a Toyota before. I'm going to get another Toyota. I had a VW before.
I'm quite aware that we're really bad at assessing truth. Like, you know, humans aren't very good at that. We're good pattern matchers mostly. But and I see a lot of reviews where someone will say it has a great weight to it. Like there's this idea that if it weighs something, if it's heavy, it's made well. that correlates. Seems to correlate
it
pretty
depends.
Well. It's not true at all. Right?
Well, if you have something that's like a trackpad or something like that you want to stay in one place, then weight is good.
Weight's good, right. But if it's like a tool and it's like, well, it seems to be made well, it has a good heft to it. It's like, well, that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to last. The ball bearings might be bad.
Yeah, I think in the old days there might have been some more weight to that. But
I see what you did there.
You know, reviews are really funny. So we had this developers conference managing and producing. We get reviews back for different sessions that different technical speakers give. And it's so funny to look at the reviews because some people have one sort of standard that they review everything by. And you
technical
see a lot of
expertise.
Yeah. You'll see all these 2- and 3-star reviews. And from the same session, you'll get people to give 5-star reviews. Oh, it was wonderful. So how do you take multiple different perceptions and put them together in a way that makes any sense?
Do you want to, talk to the Uggo team at work? Yeah, I mean, that's it's a high challenge. Of course, what you can do with your stats that you've got right now is you know who voted on what, right? Or
right,
you keep
right.
anonymous.
So you can
take a look at a person and say, oh, look, they give twos and threes, they only give one four. Therefore, their four is more important than anybody else's five because they gave lower views and higher views.
Right.
That's one way to do it. Yeah, interesting. I have a lot of knowledge about reviewing systems. That's why I was sort of curious about this, because one of the first things I did at Netflix was turned off the star ratings on the UI for iPhone and iPads. You know how you can rate movies with a star,
mm-hmm.
1 through 5, just like a review on Amazon? The thing that's interesting that what those stars mean, they don't mean that you had a good experience necessarily. They mean that you think it's a review. You're recommending it. It's about reviewing something external, not about how much joy you got from it. So even though you might not like what's a really great famous movie?
Shaun of the Dead.
You just said that because Miles quoted that earlier.
It's a great movie.
It's a great movie.
I forgot about it, but it was a great movie.
So let's do one that's just a great movie that you don't necessarily even seen, like Gone with the Wind. Okay. So if you were asked to rate Gone with the Wind, what would you rate it from 0 to 5 stars? I'd probably rate it 5 stars.
Wait, you can rate 0? I thought Netflix only had 1 to 5.
You just don't rate. So let's say 1 to 5. What would you rate it? By the way, I don't think we have this on the service in the U.S.
You know, I don't know. 4.
You'd rate it a 4?
I'd rate it a 4.
Okay. Do you like the movie? Do you want to watch it?
I don't go back to rewatch it, no.
You wouldn't go watch it necessarily.
No, but as far as craft goes, yeah, it's a great movie.
You'd have to – so you're rating it kind of on like a craft level, not necessarily whether you like it or not.
Right.
And that's kind of the problem with the rating system for us is like if you're rating it based on what it's kind of worth as a movie, it's not really getting to the gist of whether you want to watch more content like that.
Right.
Right. And so there's this underlying idea here that we're actually recording it at Netflix, so I'm saying here, but that we try to get over that just because you think something is good does not mean that you want to see more of that. And there is There's a disconnection from there. That's why I thought this review was going to be about.
Most of the things that I've ever rated, whether it be on Netflix or Amazon or the others, it has very much been based upon what I've seen on there, which is the suggestion they give. I hated it. I didn't like it. I liked it. Yeah. I really liked it. It was great.
Right. You're talking about the hover state that you can see on a website. We actually try to give a translation of those stars to mean more about how you feel.
Yeah.
That's what's actually happening. If you're on an iOS device, you don't see those hover states. So you can't actually know what the meaning is. It's just 5 stars.
Oh, I guess I've been using
just slightly different.
The streaming services for so long before I started using them on my portable devices.
Now it's imprinted in your memory.
Interesting. Anyway, I think that's fascinating that people are not necessarily – you're not actually getting the best things. But the other thing though is if you do buy the Super Pants washing machine, you probably will be happy with it, right? Because all those other people were happy. That's still valid. It might not be the best device. It might not be the best rate, all those things, but you're still going to be happy with that device.
Until it breaks down in 6 months, and then you're really mad.
But then here comes another question. How well do you take into account, for example, the recognition of institutionalized racism, which would degrade the score of Gone with the Wind over time?
Hmm.
Wait. How do you merge those two things together?
Well, no, you're trying to figure out like what is the worth of a movie? Like how good a movie is it? Because that would change over time as well.
Absolutely.
Because
it's probably a pretty racist movie. Is that what you're
saying? Well, in and of itself, when you go watch the movie in isolation, you don't think of it as being all that racist. It's just that it was a very, dare I say, whitewashed version of what antebellum slavery was.
Oh, yeah. Of course.
So,
well, it's funny with the Amazon reviews. I look at the star rating, but I mainly kind of read through what the people say. So, does that article give you any tips on what worth there is about ratings?
Well, but that's the thing, though, is that the things that people are saying are still within this subjective framing,
right? Of not seeing multiple products and just kind of having their own experience,
right?
It's uneducated reviews.
I, for myself, and here comes the big bashing I have on Apple with their stupid lightning cables. I have gone through so many lightning cables.
What do you do with – why?
They just – I didn't want to pay $30 for a cable.
Okay, so you didn't – so you got cheap cables.
But I did get an MFi certified cable. I've always gotten those.
Okay.
And
– so you don't fry your electronics?
They they all still fail.
Where
I'll go online to Amazon and find like the ones that are highest rated,
And they fail.
And they fail.
Okay. Where are they failing?
Always at the connector.
At the small connector?
Yeah.
My wife is really good at this too. She destroys them all.
Never heard
no,
one.
Not mine.
What is going on? What are you doing?
Well, for me, I do what most other people do that are computer savvy, which is taking the connector out. Like you put your finger on the connector. Or,
you hold the actual connector,
right.
Not the cord. You
right.
don't yank from the cord.
Yeah.
Just like is there someone else in your home? Like maybe the sheep or the goats that are actually chewing
somebody
it?
Under the age of four.
No, the four-year-old doesn't do it. The person slightly older than the four-year-old.
So you're saying the cable
female,
is breaking because
whose name shall not be mentioned.
Someone's pulling the cord instead of pulling the connector.
Yes.
And you think that's why it's failing?
Yes. But she also pulls the cords on, for example, the old 32-pin connector for the old iPad we have.
Well, that was just a bad connector. That was so wide. It was hard. Wait, you can't even pull that connector.
No, that's the thing, though. That one works just fine. That one never breaks.
Huh.
I mean, it takes a really long time to wear those
out. Can I suggest that you get like some epoxy and just start off by molding these things?
What's that stuff that you can mold and then you heat it up? Or what do you do? No, it air dries.
No, the thing is, though, that I also had other devices where there were micro
pellets
USB.
You could heat up with water and then you squish it around and then as it cools, it hardens.
Yeah.
Kind of like low temperature hot glue.
I've gotten some super cheap micro USB cables and got a little dongle that was a micro USB to lightning. And that has worked longer consistently than...
And the port doesn't hold on to the cable.
So I think the answer to your question is that if you read one of Miles' reviews about lightning cables, you can trust that review on Amazon because he has a lot of experience. Hey, I'm Lyle Trox. I'm with Brian and Miles. And Miles has been suggesting that we don't talk about quantum computing.
It just makes people more stupid.
But last week you mentioned that IBM had released a cloud-based quantum computing platform. And
you
with
didn't believe
eight
me.
People in the room, I went, huh? And I was like, moving on. So what? What's going on, Brian?
Okay.
How exactly is IBM going to make us all more stupid?
Yeah, exactly.
No, we're going to do that right now. We're all going to be stupider by the time we're done with this article.
Okay, I've got notes that go like several pages long here.
And that's on an
iPad. And we're still going to sound stupid.
And I'm not at all going to claim to be authoritative or understanding everything I'm about to say.
Okay.
But we're still going to talk about it anyway.
Now's the chance to end the podcast. We'll see you next week. Here you go, Brian.
There's a few takeaways here. So, yes, they've got a quantum computer. Is this something that's going to factor out primes and destroy encryption as we know it tomorrow?
I assume no?
No.
Okay.
And Miles brought this point up last week. What it is with 5 qubits, we'll come back to that. Don't worry about that. With a 5-qubit computer, you're able to do a very, very limited set of algorithms and functions on this computer. And what they're doing is they're trying to open this up to researchers and people interested in quantum computing, people that actually understand it, and allow them to play with this system to increase the understanding of quantum computing and create innovation while they're continuing the process of making larger and more complex, more qubit quantum computers. So their goal is in the next 5 to 10 years to have what they'd call a 50-qubit quantum computer, at which point they can start to do some much more complex things that get closer to what they call a universal quantum machine.
So, okay, so what we're talking about here is quantum computers are about the same level as computers when Alan Turing started playing with them.
Exactly.
Like, started playing with them.
Started
playing
because,
with them.
Because like the machine that broke Enigma had a lot more bits than 5.
Right.
I mean, they were disks and they were totally different. But
let's not compare the number of bits to qubits.
But I mean, it was hardwired for a particular purpose.
Exactly.
Well, I think it's valid to compare bits to qubits because even though they are completely different, they're a paradigm shift in how the computers work. Still, the rudimentary level of having 5 bits on a machine versus having a machine that actually works as we think of as computers is totally valid. Like having a 5-bit machine right now would do nothing for you.
Right.
It's like having a whole bunch of light switches on a table. Like that's the computing power you have. Congratulations.
Well,
having
yeah.
you know, like 5 relays in a table. It's similar to that. Now, of course, they are qubits, so you have entanglement. You have properties. You don't have to coalesce your answers. You can actually do the magic that makes you stupid in quantum theory. But it is still a very rudimentary machine.
Yes.
Just to be clear, the amount of bits in my machine is 1. Like I have 16 gigabytes in this machine. This is 64-bit.
Of RAM storage.
Of RAM storage. Yeah, I'm just talking about RAM storage. Like, okay, we could talk about the processing power instead.
Well,
how many registers on the CPU? I don't even know of this machine. How much registers?
Well, it's 64-bit wide data bus.
If
you have SIMD, then you are working with like 128-bit values in parallel, or 128 values where you can split off into multiple things going in parallel.
Right. If you can vector it.
Yes.
So
the point is that the scale is completely different.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
So 5 bits gives you something interesting to play with, but it's not going to outcompete any computer that exists right now. Getting up to 50 or 100 qubits gets you in the territory that you can start factoring those prime numbers and getting some scary computing power.
In 100 bits? Qubits?
Yeah, 50 to 100 qubits. And that's what they're talking about achieving in the next 5 to 10 years.
Wait. If they already have 5 qubits, 50 to 100 qubits should be moments away.
Okay, so there's a lot of technology going on here. So some of this is really fascinating. Like, in order to get this machine to work, they have to cool it down to less than outer space temperatures, okay. Really close to absolute zero. What is that? I got that note somewhere.
Now, bear in mind, Lyle, you're not talking about the amount of RAM, because that would go very quickly. We're talking more along the lines of getting from a 4-bit computer to an 8-bit computer to a 16-bit to a 32-bit, and that was a much longer time frame.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we're not even talking about that. We don't have a bus yet. We don't have – like, these aren't even words. These aren't even bytes yet. This is bits. So right. It's not even like – I don't think you can – Go ahead and keep talking about this.
Well, no. I was going to talk about the technology because this stuff's really complex that they're doing to be able to make all these qubits work together. So when you start adding more qubits to it, it just makes the system increasingly more complex.
Okay.
And that's equivalent to going from a 12-bit to a 16-bit to a 32-bit processor. It's a pretty complex jump to create a process that can handle
that. An example of this is that for quantum computer work, you actually have to have the bits interact with each other in a quantum way.
Right.
So you have to have entanglement occurring at bit level. And therefore, when you build a machine, all these things actually have to not coalesce into our normal space, if you will, but stay in that quantum realm. And therefore, it all has to stay small. It all has to stay really cold. And it has to be interconnected, not with like – you don't have ability to store something in memory. You have to keep a waveform in a quantum field, right? Like I know we're not getting the depths of this, but that's why it's so complex.
Right.
Okay.
And the technology is complex. And there's a few things that I thought were really interesting about this. First of all, some people have access to a quantum computer and they'll have access to it from their own standard digital computer over the web. That's really cool. So the technology involved in making a quantum computer to get these super low temperatures, we're not going to be able to carry this around in our pocket or even have this in our house for ever, maybe.
Right.
But here we go. We have access to it from our computers in the same way we have access to AI through Siri or through Google, where our phones and our computers contact it and bring the data back to us. So people are going to be starting to use quantum technology and quantum computers before they even know that this thing exists, because soon software will start trying to take advantage of this. And that's what IBM's trying to jumpstart here by giving people access to it to play with it.
For varying definitions of soon.
Well, soon.
Sure.
Come on, 5 years.
Well,
what, the iPhone's now 9 years old?
Right.
10?
Sooner now than it was before they had this online.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's the whole idea, is that you kind of have to move this forward. But the thing that I found so mind-boggling when you mentioned this the other day is that from my limited understanding of quantum computing, you have to think about programming in a completely different way. Like, the paradigm of digital computing does not work. It's not the same thing. And therefore, our languages that are based around using ones and zeros in a computational way that, with memory space and allocation and heaps and all that stuff that we think of as a computer, does not translate perfectly.
Right.
So we have to come up with whole new ways of thinking.
Right.
And that's what they're trying to do, right?
Right.
Get
if
us
you,
thinking that
if
way.
If you give researchers or people who have a minimal understanding of quantum computing a chance to play with it, then their thought patterns, their idea of how algorithms work are going to start molding to the new way of thinking, the new quantum computers.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, well, there's one other thing I wanted to throw in here. It's really hard for even me to understand quantum computing, but I love this quote. One of the main researchers involved in this is Charles Bennett, and there's a video on IBM's site trying to explain some of this to the general public.
Oh, awesome.
And a lot of these videos, they're totally worth watching. You may not walk away feeling smarter, but you may walk away feeling, wow, that might exist in this world.
And we'll link to those from GeekSpeak.com.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the quotes that Charles Bennett says is that Schrodinger. Thank you. We've all heard about his experiment, Schrodinger's cat,
and a thought experiment
that you can't know whether the cat is alive or dead in the box before opening the box up.
And in fact, just prior to you opening the box, the cat is both alive and dead.
Exactly. And this is a way to explain quantum mechanics. And the quote from Charles Bennett is that people totally misunderstand the importance of Schrodinger's work. And his quote is that the ultimate upshot of Schrodinger's work is that he showed that you can have some system that is in a known state, but its parts are unknown. You can't know the individual parts, what state they're in, but you can know what the overall whole is. And I thought that was a fascinating way to think about quantum mechanics.
Which is actually how the world really works. Like, we don't actually know at a quantum level what anything's what's happening. It's all an unknown, but it coalesces. And that's why I keep on using that term, coalesce. Coalesces into the microphone in front of me being a real physical thing, even though we don't know all the parts about it.
Right, that's which is where our real-world intuition comes from,
yeah.
which we not
have to let go
world.
Of. And that's why you feel stupider. All of a sudden, your intuition just doesn't work anymore. Okay, so we recommend those videos. Cool. And yep. We'll get to those from geekspeak.org. And this show is the May 11th episode of GeekSpeak, or episode 19 of season 16. Miles, one more story to finish us off.
Speaking of videos, there are folks talking about the end of prison visitation. Now, this is a little Orwellian, so just prepare everyone for that. The idea of video visitation is – as opposed to in-person jail visits.
Okay. There's different kinds of in-person jail visits. There's being in front of a glass wall and talking through a microphone, and there's actually sitting at a table with people.
Mm-hmm.
Does this go into which kind they're talking about?
This goes into the person isn't even in the jail. The prisoner's in the jail, and the person visiting them is not. They're physically disparate places, and they're doing what amounts to a glitchy, expensive Skype-like video call.
Okay. And, of course, being monitored.
Yes. And, of course, being monitored.
It is jail.
And it turns out that it, aside from being Orwellian and really odd and dissociative, it actually increases in-prison violence.
Because of the disassociative effect of video?
Taking away the what little closeness you had, because one of the issues with prison is the separation you have with people who are outside. The thing that really makes this pernicious is the fact that the video system that is in place is expensive and therefore makes a lot of money.
Oh, no.
Which
no.
means
who
there's a very good
it?
Expensive – oh, the people who are trying to visit the prisoners. The family.
See, one of the things I thought of is that people that are trying to visit prisons won't have to travel that far. Sometimes, you know, your loved one might be put in some prison far away, and therefore the travel expenses are really high. So I was like, oh, cool, we could do video Skyping, and then they can see each other more often. But first off, they're talking about replacing in-prison visits, because of course those are expensive because guards have to be on duty and all that. Also, making money off of it from the family.
Mm-hmm.
That's horrible.
So.
And with that, this is us. Thanks for the uplifting story. Well, so is there any voting happening on this, or is it just happening?
No, it's just happening because by and large, the individual day-to-day operations of prisons is not governed by a popular vote. How many of us voted to have private prisons in general, let alone the inner workings of those prisons?
This is all prisons are doing this, or the private prison system?
No, there's one in particular that they were talking about in this article from tech.mike. And you can find out more by reading the links on our website.
Yeah. And I got to say, though, that prison reform clearly has to happen. I mean, the whole justice system is pretty screwed up in this country. Speaking of serial, that was one of the side effects.
Just to give you an idea, it's a 20-minute maximum for the video chat and charge $10.
Oh, my God. That's ridiculous.
Nobody ever thought of using Skype?
Well, you have to give the prisoners access to it.
It has to be like a lockdown computer.
All of us are thinking in terms of, well, how much would a business account cost for internet access versus and then opening up a gateway and then having someone access it?
No, sure. It's more complicated than that, obviously.
So can we take anything else from this, like when we talk to our loved ones over FaceTime and Skype, that we're not connecting with them well and we're going to have a higher rate of violence in our life?
Well, I think you're gonna have a disassociation with them, but your normal life's not gonna be in prison. So the disassociation with your family means you're gonna be at work more. So yeah, it takes a toll.
and your family might dissociate themselves from you because you're not spending any time with them.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark. David Lawrence is used with permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Lose our stuff any way you'd like it. Just tell them we said hi. Thanks to our intern Chandler, our support geek Greg Merkley, who provided this week's working title: Qubits Cause Podcast Cancer. And thanks for our theme song of Michael Newman. And thank you for listening to episode 19 of our 16th season. And of course, to Brian and to Miles, thanks for being here this week.
Always a pleasure.
Podcast fun.